All right, don't cry in front of the Mexicans.
But my hands are registered as lethal weapons. That means we get into a fight, I accidentally kill you, I go to jail. Anybody who accidentally kills anybody in a fight goes to jail. It's called manslaughter.
My buddy and his dog killed two of them, and no shit, I torched the last one. Torched? Yeah, I burnt her ass to a crisp.
Anything we can do about that heat? Rick, it's a flamethrower. Yeah?
Well, you're drinking all night, drinking all them goddamn 8 fucking whiskey sours? Fucking bullshit. You look like a fucking jerk. Can't remember your lines. I practiced them. Now I look like I goddamn didn't practice them. You're sitting there like a fucking baboon. Do, 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 do. 8 fucking whiskey sours. Could stop at 3 or 4. Had 8. Why?
Oh my gosh. When you come to the end of the line with a buddy who is more than a brother and a little less than a wife, getting blind drunk together is really the only way to say farewell.
Oh, man. I'm Brucker.
I'm Levi.
And on this episode of Film on the Rocks, we are talking about the Quentin Tarantino 2019 movie, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I am so excited to finally be talking about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Levi, how are you doing?
I'm good, man. I'm excited for you. You've been talking about, like, obviously, like, if our listeners could be a fly on the wall, essentially every time we have a conversation, you will at some point mention Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. You've been really excited about it. So I am excited for you, and I'm excited for you to get me excited about it.
Yes, this movie is kind of divisive or kind of polarizing between some people. Like, people either come out of it going, holy crap, that was amazing, or some people come out going, I'm lost, I don't really get what that was about. And that kind of seems to be the two main reactions that people get from watching this.
Yeah, I mean, I can recognize that it's a, like, it seems like a good movie. The acting was good, you know, I have no, like, complaints about it. It was a Tarantino movie for sure, and I can recognize that there's some, like, really good, you know, we'll dig into the semantics of it, but yeah, like, you have just been praising it like crazy, so I'm so excited to hear your opinion.
Yeah, this movie is great. I'll kind of go into some of the credentials before we get into our official opinions. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, this movie came out last year, 2019. This was directed and written by Quentin Tarantino, starring Leonardo DiCaprio, Brad Pitt, and Margot Robbie. This movie had a budget of $90 million. It made $41 million its opening weekend and grossed over $374 million worldwide. This movie...
That's a Tarantino movie right there.
Oh, absolutely. And Tarantino was inspired to do this movie while he was actually making his film Death Proof. He was on the set and, you know, they weren't, in this point in time, they weren't currently filming. They were just kind of like on a set, either like in between takes or, you know, what have you. And he looked across the room and he saw, I don't know what actor, but he saw an actor and their respective stunt double sitting in director chairs talking to each other. And he thought to himself, what an interesting relationship that is between the actor and their stunt double. And it kind of got him thinking about some like famous actor stunt double duos from like the, you know, 60s, like Steve McQueen and Bud Atkins or Burt Reynolds and Hal Needham, because, you know, they did all their movies together. And it's he said that must be like a very unique relationship. And he kind of thought about how, you know, we don't have these actor stuntman duos too much anymore. And there's other reasons why he kind of like wrote, you know, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. It was he himself is an LA kid from like the 60s 70s era. This movie takes place in 1969, and this is very much a love letter from him to LA, Hollywood, the 60s. It's kind of him just gushing over this very specific time in movie history. And I really get all the love that he put into this. I will say, the first time I watched this movie, Levi, I was kind of lost. The first time I left it, I kind of didn't exactly get the point of this. Like, this movie really had to marinate in my brain for a couple of days. And this movie has, this movie only came out last year, but in between the time I first saw it and the time I rewatched it, it aged really well in that small time span. Because, you know, I got to think about it more. I had conversations about it with people. And I finally kind of got what this movie was about. I'll get into that in a little bit. So I love this movie. I think it's a lot of fun. I'm really interested to see you seeing it for the first time. What are your thoughts and opinions, initial reactions coming out of it?
So when I came out of the movie, I recognized that it was a good movie. I figured kind of by the end that the whole point of it was kind of this lifting the veil on Hollywood, kind of behind the scenes, like looking at, you know, what these people stood for or what these people did kind of behind the scenes in Hollywood, and getting to see, you know, Margot Robbie's character, like being like, hey, that's me, I'm famous. Can I go watch my own movie? Or, you know, them, you know, seeing the actors kind of lose their minds over forgetting lines, or even those, the scenes where you know, calling out the line, or it's, you know, serious, go back to camera spot B or whatever. And I figured it was just kind of Quentin Tarantino's kind of salute to, like you say, it's kind of to where he came from, which is super sweet, but also kind of this salute to this classic era of cinema that inspired him to be who he is and to create the films that he makes, these westerns, these, you know, kind of this actor on the way out and this kind of has been stunt double. I just assumed it was kind of a salute to the business and a kind of lifting of the curtain to see behind the scenes a little bit. But and you know, if that's what it is, it's a very fun movie with kind of this interlacing of Charles Manson and, yeah, and kind of this cult. But yeah, I don't know if that's necessarily what I'm supposed to get out of it, but at least that's what the Charles Manson part, I just assume was kind of the big thing that was happening during that time that Tarantino kind of had to include. I don't know if what about you? Is that kind of, am I on the right trail?
Yeah. So, I mean, no, I think this movie is about a lot of things, and a lot of them are things that you just touched on. Tarantino's, you know, not giving the tip of the hat to people who have been developing the craft of cinema.
Right.
And, you know, 69, you know, late 60s, early 70s was kind of this turning point in it. And this is kind of him, you know, tipping his hat to people that were a part of this. Also a time that he loved. He's such a hippie. When I was watching all of these behind the scenes videos, whenever he was on set directing, he was dressed like a hippie when he was on set.
That's funny.
You know, he's wearing a shirt, no shoes, had a bandana on. He was just immersed in this. Quentin Tarantino is one of those directors where it's so interesting just listening to him talk. Like, you know, he talks super fast, and he's like, you know, always, you know, really energetic. He's like this, that. But for this movie, you know, he is just, it's like that times 10, because he's just, this is one of his babies, like this movie. And again, because there's so much of this that he pulled from his own life a little bit. One of the things I love about this movie is just all of the scenes we just get of Brad Pitt or Cliff just by himself in a car just driving in L.A. And we're just listening to the radio. He said that, you know, that's what his stepdad did with him when he was a kid in L.A. You know, that's what this reminded him of. And that's why he wanted to put this in here, because he remembered just being in the car with his stepdad and just listening to the radio. The music in this, by the way, the music in this movie is terrific.
Oh, it's so good.
Such a fun soundtrack.
And that's kind of what you mentioned, those scenes of them driving. Like, that's kind of what Tarantino, of all the things, his kind of signatures that he's known for, that's one of the big ones, of kind of the scenes that are nothing, but that are everything. Like the, the first one I automatically think of outside of this movie is the Pulp Fiction, like the Royale with cheese conversation. They're in the car and they're just talking about cheeseburgers. Has nothing to do with the movie, or does it have everything to do with the movie? I don't know. You know, it's just like conversations about nothing. But that's what real life is just conversations about nothing. So them driving down the street and them kind of them the camera sitting in the back seat as they get off of an exit and kind of just sitting behind them as they're listening to the radio and continuing down the road. Yeah, it just it felt very, very Tarantino-esque.
Oh, definitely. I also felt like it was a very clever device and something very simple for character development too, because you know, like some stories you tell, some stories you show. And when Cliff and Rick first leave in the beginning of the movie, they first leave their meeting with Al Pacino's character in the beginning, you know, Rick is having this midlife crisis. He's like, I'm washed up as an actor or whatever. He's talking about how his career's over, but he it's ironic because, you know, he still has this nice car that he can't even drive, and he lives in Hollywood. So it's like, how bad is your life? That's what we're told, and we kind of see it too. And then immediately after Cliff drops him off, we see Cliff drive home in his beat up car, and Cliff is telling him, man, you don't have it that bad. And we see he has a beat up car, but also in this drive home from Cliff, he drives like a stuntman, you know? I mean, he drives fast and reckless, and he's blasting the music. He has the top down. It felt like that there was a lot of, in an odd way, you got some character development just by watching Cliff drive.
Totally. Yeah. 100%
agree. And stuff like that I liked. But kind of getting back to what our initial opinions were and what we kind of thought this movie was about, because I remember seeing trailers for this and I was thinking, oh man, Tarantino's doing a Charles Manson movie. Like, this is going to be bonkers. And it's...
Yeah.
It is about the Manson family, but it also isn't about the Manson family. Like, they're in it, and I remember my first qualms with this movie was that I didn't really get the purpose of Shannon Tate being in this movie, or Margot Robbie's character, because I felt like she didn't do anything. And I don't know about you, but I was very much just like, I don't get what the purpose of this was, because there's like three threads in this movie. There's Rick's story, there's Cliff's story, and there's Sharon Tate's story, but her story has the least amount of like action in it.
Right. Yeah. I always assumed, you know, at the end of the movie, not during, I kind of during, I was like, why are you here? At the end, you know, because you know what happens to her in real life. She's just brutally murdered as she's, you know, 8 months pregnant or whatever. Just this horrific, horrific time. And it kind of shows, I don't know, in my mind, it just showed this alternate. I think it kind of shows it's an alternate timeline, clearly.
Right.
Which, because, you know, because she survives. I don't know if this means, this is kind of some theory talk a little bit. I don't know if this means, considering that Quentin Tarantino's movies are all in the same universe, does this mean that Quentin Tarantino's universe is the universe where Shannon Tate was not murdered?
I think it's like so this movie is obviously, because it's a movie, it's fantasy. I think it's even more so like Tarantino saying this is a fantasy story because it's called Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Because this movie ends with, and I kind of just want to go ahead and touch on Sharon Tate's stuff in this.
Please.
Because like I said, and you kind of said during the movie as you're watching, you're trying to figure out what exactly is going on with this character, right? We're just seeing her have a normal day, because we're seeing Sharon Tate the person, not Sharon Tate the victim. And we're just seeing this is she, like, it's, I believe it's Tarantino trying to remind us she was a human being. She was more than just a victim of this heinous crime. Like, she went out, she went to movies, she you know, she had loved ones that she saw on a regular basis, and she loved to dance, she loved to, you know, just play records in her house and just dance when nobody was watching. And I think that was the point that he was trying to remind us, hey, she was human and she had human tendencies, and this was just him being like, remember, she had all these aspects. And actually her sister, Deborah Tate, they got her blessing of the script, and also they got her sister's blessing of the hiring or casting of Margot Robbie to be Sharon Tate in this. And they actually had Deborah Tate on set during those scenes to kind of, again, just give her blessing of, yes, this is exactly how, or at least close to how my sister was. This was her bubbly, lovely personality. There's nothing saying that they had to do that, but I think it's very respectful that they did. We'll talk about the ending scene a little bit later, I'm sure. But we see that this Sharon Tate avoids becoming a victim. And at the end, she gets to hear what happened. And then, you know, Rick Dalton comes and talks to her and tells, and then they become friends. And then, you know, the movie fades out and it ends once upon a time in Hollywood. And it's kind of like, this is what it could have been. And
okay.
And that's kind of like what I got from it. It was, you know, this is a love letter from, you know, a personal one from Tarantino about like his childhood, you know, why he loved LA to Hollywood itself, and also reminding people, you know, Sharon Tate was more than a victim. She was a human being, and, you know, let's all sit down, eat some popcorn, have a whiskey sour, and pretend what could have been.
Okay, so is this not supposed to be then like canon Tarantino? Like, is this supposed to be kind of him not building his universe, but rather just kind of a story?
I don't know that for a fact, but I mean, I think it's just a story, especially just because of the title itself. It would be one thing if the movie was just called like L.A. 1969, you know, just saying like a fact, this is how L.A. was in 1969. But since it's given, you know, a fairy tale title, Once Upon a Time, I feel like, I don't know if he's trying to make this like canon with anything else.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, I guess. So you're saying the title kind of disqualifies it from being canon?
Yeah. I think so, at least. I mean, that's just my opinion.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm gonna. Yeah, maybe. Yeah, yeah. I guess I'm gonna. Because I just thought about the theory right now. I don't know. That kind of gives us an opening into. Because as far as I'm aware, this is the first historically inspired movie that Tarantino has made, right?
Like, No.
Is it based on semi-true events?
Oh, I mean, there's Django Unchained, and then there's Inglourious Bastards.
Right, but like, is that? Well, I guess Inglourious Bastards is a good one. Django Unchained, like, I guess that's true.
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of things in this that are based on real. Like Bounty Law was not a real show, but all the other shows that Rick Dalton was the heavy on were real shows, like Lancer that we saw. That's real. FBI was real. He was inspired. So the character Rick Dalton was the anti-Steve McQueen, basically. Because right. Steve McQueen, he did Wanted Dead or Alive. And then he transitioned from being a TV star to he was able to pivot into films. And he did it successfully. Right. And Rick Dalton he said he based Rick Dalton off Steve McQueen, but if Steve McQueen couldn't make that transfer as easy.
And Steve McQueen is an actual character in it too.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Yes,
he is. Which is what I guess more what I'm saying is like, has there been a movie like where we've seen characters that are actually real people in real life?
I mean, I'm sure. I mean, you know, you have actors play themselves lots of times in movies.
I mean, in Quentin Tarantino.
I'm sorry. Not that I know of.
And that's more of what I'm saying. Kind of like being like Sharon Tate. That was like she is a real person. Like,
gotcha.
Bruce Lee is a real person. Charles Manson. You know, mm-hmm. and all of the like Tex and Squeaky and all of these people who were like part of the Manson family were real people in the Manson family. So I'm wondering if it's like, is this the first movie where we kind of get an anchor into reality from Tarantino?
I'm not sure. I mean, Inglourious Bastards, you know, that's set in, you know World War II was real,
right?
And you know, Nazis were real. But I don't know if there's like a real figure. I'm pretty sure the main characters in that movie are based off of maybe a collection of different individuals.
Sure.
Oh, my dog is bark sleeping. Sorry. But
we all bark sleeping.
Yeah. But you know what? I'm not sure. I'm not I'm not super fresh on other Quentin Tarantino movies to properly answer that. So I'm not sure. That's a good question, though.
Yeah. I don't know. I'll have to check into that.
Like I said, first time watching it, I was kind of lost on everything. But after everything marinated, and I was also looking at it with probably too harsh of a critical eye the first time I watched it. And the second time, I was able, because I kind of already made my decision of like, okay, everything I nitpicked were nitpicks, and I really just need to enjoy the movie and shut up. And when I sat down to rewatch it for this, oh my god, this is such a fun movie. Like, this might be the most rewatchable movie of 2019, I think. I mean, it's...
Oh, dang.
I mean, I know I love Knives Out. I might like this more. Like, it's from 2019. I mean, it's such a good movie. I think, Levi, if the second time you sit down to watch this movie, you'll pick up on how much fun this is again. Like, it'll kind of just like hit you. Love this movie.
Okay, let me, if this has something to do with your meaning, just tell me you're gonna wait, but like, did you ever say what it was that just made this movie so, like, better than Knives Out? You love Knives Out.
I love Knives Out. I think this one is slightly more rewatchable just because it's such a fun ride, and it's very, I mean, parts of it are funny, parts of it have action. It's just such a fun movie, and like, it's so quotable too. We did our quotes, and Al Pacino is in this movie for maybe 8 minutes, like, at most. And like, the 8 minutes we got of him were just great. You know, he walks in and he sees Rick Dalton and Cliff Booth at the bar. He looks over to Cliff. He goes, "Hey, is that your son?" Like, huh. It's so funny. And he walks in. He has so many golden lines. "Last night, me and my wife, we had a Cliff Dalton fucking film festival." Like, it's just so, it's like every like little character that we get, it like Tarantino's just able to just paint such a quick picture of them. You're like, wow, like, I get who they are, and I love it. Like, he even like says how, like, "After my wife went to bed, I brought out the cigars, pour myself a cognac, and I put on the 14th Fist of McCluskey." Like, it's like, oh man, that's a night I want to have. Like, it's great.
Dude, I still, you're saying it, I still can't understand. It's a good movie. I don't know.
Oh man, okay, well, let's go through our drinking rules and see what all you pointed out, and then we'll go through the scenes and see if there's any more arm twisting I could do to...
Please do, man. I want my arm to be twisted. I want to experience this movie the same way you do. this movie was kind of harder for me to find drinking rules.
Okay.
But I did find, I did grab five of them. Whenever Rick has a meltdown of some kind.
Oh, that's a good one.
Take a drink. Whatever constitutes a meltdown for you, if you want to change the word meltdown to anytime he gets like really emotional, because you get emotional doesn't mean it's a meltdown. Whatever word you want to replace with meltdown, take a drink, because he does that a lot, because the poor guy's kind of having a midlife crisis a little bit on his career and his ability to continue with the times and whatever. Anytime the words hippie or stuntman are said.
Okay.
The word, I was just going to put hippie, but the word stuntman is thrown around a lot in this one too. So hippie or stuntman. Take your pick. Whenever there is a clear comparison between the wealth of Rick and the lack of wealth by Cliff, or of Cliff.
Gotcha.
So the kind of this Rick versus Cliff comparison, you kind of touched on it with the cars, like the nice car that Rick is driven around in, and Cliff's car, the kind of drinks that they buy. Like, you have Rick buying these clear, like gin and tonic or
whiskey sours is what he's making.
Yeah. Oh yeah, whiskey sours, and you have Cliff having just like this, you know, a Bloody Mary or whatever, eating the celery, like taking, like not leaving any bit of the, like Rick will like take a sip and like leave it, and Cliff is taking every bit of what he ordered and finishing it.
Did,
what were you saying?
I was going to say, did you notice what the name of the beer was in Cliff's trailer?
I don't know if I noticed. What was it called?
It's a made-up name that Tarantino came up with, but it's called Old Chattanooga Beer.
No way!
Yeah.
Oh, shout out to Chat Town. Let's go.
I love that. I love that. It's like one of my favorite little like pieces of trivia.
Old Chattanooga Beer. I love that. But the shoes... Like the shoes that they wear, you have these like really, Rick always wears these nice shoes and Cliff always wears these like moccasins or whatever. That house is, you know, that they live in, the trailer versus this like McMansion that Rick lives in and whatever. So just that kind of comparison, when you see this clear kind of juxtaposition between their status and their wealth, take a drink. Whenever there is a shot where feet are the focal point. As we have said in the past, and if you've watched any Tarantino movies, you know that he kind of has this, you know, I don't know if he has a foot fetish or not, but he has this tendency to really kind of put a spotlight on people's feet. And so a lot of shots of people walking in their feet, you have Margot Robbie take her shoes off and put her feet up on the back of the chair, and it kind of like
in the theater,
it, with her feet are kind of that young girl that Cliff picks up, and she's got Pussycat. Her feet up on the dashboard. Yeah, Pussycat, her feet are up on the dashboard, pressed up against the windshield, all this stuff. So anytime that happens, and you see kind of feet in the shot,
it's forced.
Not. Yeah, it's clearly forced. Somebody clearly was like, "All right, get her feet in that shot."
Yeah, it's kind of like who takes their feet off at a theater? Not their feet off. Wow, who takes their shoes off in a theater?
That also must be asked. Who takes their feet off in the theater?
I was going. Yeah. I have a question for you about that.
Please.
I don't know if you noticed, but the shot we get of Pussycat, you know, she's a hippie, and when she shows her feet are clean. But Sharon Tate, when she's in the theater, she takes off her shoes and she kicks her feet up. The bottom of her feet are dirty, like they're filthy. Do you think do you think that was like intentional, or is there any sort of statement about that?
I think that speaks to the quality of concrete versus a movie theater carpet. I think that's what it says. Like, good gracious, there's, you know, what kind of like diseases are on that? Oh my gosh! Like, no, I don't know. I don't know if that's. I don't know if that's supposed to be a, but she, I mean, she is like that. I mean, not like she is a child. Pussycat is, however, she's definitely younger than 18, or she's supposed to be, because everyone that Charles Manson kind of preyed on was innocent and kind of very, very, very young. This is kind of, maybe it's an innocence thing, I don't know, but like Sharon Tate wasn't like a villain or anything. She didn't do anything just like horrific. She's just like, you know, an innocent, you know, actress or whatever. So I don't know if it was symbolic or not. I think Quentin Tarantino was just like, take off your shoes. But you know, my last drinking rule, this is your finish your drink whenever Quentin Tarantino makes his cameo.
Is he in this movie? I didn't see him.
He is. His voice is in it. Do you know when his voice is in the movie?
No, I don't know this.
So it's still technically in the movie, but it's an end credit scene where you have Rick, who's doing a Red Apple cigarette commercial, and you can hear a director in the background kind of every once in a while giving him direction, and that's Quentin Tarantino's voice.
That's fun.
Yeah, so he made it. He made a cameo. I'm not 100% sure if he makes a cameo in every single one of his movies. I don't think he's in Hateful Eight.
And I don't think he's in Inglourious Basterds, unless I missed it. I don't think he's in that.
I know he's in Django. I know he's in...
Who is he in Django?
He's the guy who... I've only seen bits and pieces of it, but
it's been years since I've seen that movie.
He captures Django and then he lets Django out and then he shoots them all up. Like it's a cage. It's like a traveling cell. It's like a cell on wheels or something like that. For some reason they let him out and then he kills all of them or something. I don't know, but he does make an appearance in that. I know he's in Pulp Fiction. He plays the guy who makes the good coffee.
Right, yeah.
But yeah, and, whenever you hear his voice, which will be the end, finish your drink. So if you've just poured yourself a fresh one, you're in trouble. But if you're near the pour yourself a cognac. So yeah, those are my five. What about you, Brooker?
Oh man, I had a lot of fun with this. You and I overlapped on one or two. I had instead of like Rick having a meltdown, I had whenever his insecurities surface.
That is a better way of putting it. I would change mine from the word meltdown to a surfacing insecurities. I think that I like that wording better.
Yeah, I mean he's freaking out this movie because he feels like he's a washed up actor, and that's something else that this movie is about. This movie is about aging. I mean, Cliff and Rick are towards the end of their career while Sharon Tate is at the very beginning. So this movie is about like contrasting those two things as well. Mm. Rick is very, I don't know if I want to say stubborn, because I don't know if we really get that, but he's not exactly quick to make the changes that he needs to make, you know?
Right.
But, so like one of his insecurities surfaces, especially when one of my favorite parts too was when he shows up to Lancer to be the heavy on the show, and he has this conversation with that female child actor, and he is just like he's like asking her all these questions or whatnot. He's just burying himself in this book, and he's talking about Easy Breezy, and it's obviously Easy Breezy's story is very much Rick Dalton's story as well. He can't stop himself from crying a bunch. Oh gosh. So yeah, so whatever his insecurities pop up, which is happening throughout most of the film, take a drink.
Yeah, it does a lot.
Yeah. This might be dangerous. This is semi-dangerous, but whenever you hear music playing from a car, take a drink.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. You might need to, if you're with a group, you might need to split the cars by color or something.
Yeah.
Like that. Oh, that does sound dangerous.
So that's one of my drinking rules. A movie that they always bring up in this is the 14th Fist of McCluskey. So whatever that movie is brought up, take a drink, which that sounds like such a cool movie.
It does.
Maybe that's
Tarantino calling out his next movie. Maybe that's going to be, because technically he said he would only make 10, right?
Mm-hmm. And yeah, this was his ninth.
That might be his last movie.
The 14th Fist of McCluskey? That would be really cool.
That would be super cool. You heard it here first. I'm making the call right now. That's his 10th movie.
And on the movie posters, they don't say Leonardo DiCaprio. They say Rick Dalton. Just
yes.
Give it to me.
Oh, my gosh.
I want that so bad now. So my next drinking rule is somebody brings up Cliff's dead wife. Which, when I get done with my rules, I'll ask you whether or not you think he did it or not. But so whenever somebody brings up Cliff's dead wife or that he killed his wife. And then my last drinking rule is I got a lot of scrutiny for this this rule from Kat, because she thought that this rule was for babies. But
oh my gosh.
So as in like it's too easy of a rule, but I like it. Whenever we see Sharon Tate dancing, take a drink.
Okay. Oh, why did she not like that rule?
Kat was like, oh, she doesn't dance that much in this movie. I'm like, only like every other scene we see her in, but okay. Whenever she comes up with drinking rules, it's something that happens like every other second. I'm like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Like, we can't drink every time somebody says and. Like it's just too much. You know?
Yeah.
But I really like that because... Oh, I'm talking about the dancing rule, just because it really helped add to her... character and personality. She's this happy-go-lucky person, and it was just a lot of fun.
That's a good one. I think it's fun whenever she dances, even if it's once she does dance, it counts.
She dances at the Playboy Mansion, and then she's just in her room by herself. She puts on a record, she just starts dancing as she's doing laundry or whatever it is that she was doing. This is such a fun person. So I had to do a rule for her. I really like our rules, and man, this is such a fun movie. This is a really good sit down drinking movie. I think that this is I really think this is one of the first movies we've done that like, hey, this is a fun, you're gonna sit down, you're gonna pour yourself whatever and like just enjoy it.
Yeah, and it's kind of goes away. Well, not really, but Tarantino's is also known for just being like over the top, bloody, gory, mm-hmm. gushy kind of, and we do get that at the end, like just over, just over the top violence. You know, yeah. It's just like it's not just. It's bashing someone into a table three times and then taking the same person and moving over to the mantle and bashing it into the head three times and then moving over to the other table and doing it. It's just over the top level of violence.
Yeah.
But you don't really see that until really the last, like, I mean, I don't know, 15 minutes, if that, yeah. maybe more or less rather. But yeah, so it's kind of, you don't really have to, there's no suspense. It's just kind of a sit and kind of go through the scenes.
Yeah. Oh, it definitely is. And it's a hangout movie. It's such a fun hangout movie. So before we get into the specific scenes that we enjoyed or, you know, what stuck out to us, I kind of want to ask you the unanswerable question of this movie. Did Cliff Booth kill his wife?
I say, yeah, that's like me thinking like, yeah,
it's you thinking about it.
Yeah. That's like, yes, I see your question.
Yes, that is a question.
Yeah, right. I'm acknowledging. Yeah, I've acknowledged that Brooker has asked the question. I've thought a lot. That's the question I've really thought about, is because we don't get an answer at the end. Mm-hmm. There is no answer. Immediately, my thought was, because you see she's kind of like, you know, the scene is set where she's talking about how her husband, Cliff, is just this deadbeat piece of crap. And, oh, I hate him. Oh, he's lazy. Or
yeah, she's complaining about him a bunch. Yeah, how she's just bored.
Yeah, he's so boring. He's just sitting there drinking his beer on our boat. We're doing nothing fun or whatever. And he's, you know, I don't know if she uses the word deadbeat. I don't think she does that. But he's not a deadbeat. Like, he's a stuntman. He does, like, crazy stuff all the time. And she's like, mm-hmm. I hate my husband. And you see him holding a harpoon.
Yeah.
You know, sitting in this chair. And he's clearly been drinking, and he's a little drunk. I don't know. And then it cuts, and that's the only thing that we get to see.
Yeah.
And you're kind of led to believe that, like, because this woman, like, you know, we get to know Cliff, and yeah. Cliff is not a mean guy. Well, if anything, like,
I think he's a really mean guy. Like, he's not a good person. I mean, he's a really good friend, but I don't think, like, his moral compass is a little skewed.
Do tell.
You know, he's super loyal to Rick, you know,
right.
I mean, he's an excellent friend, but he's a dangerous person. I mean, you know, he's trained, he fought in the Korean War, they said, which, you know, being a veteran doesn't make you dangerous. I'm just saying he has the ability to be dangerous if he wanted to. And,
sure.
You know, we see him and Rick have a little like game, but like, you know, he's like, hey, Rick, give me back my sunglasses. He goes, come get him, motherfucker. And he, like, puts his fist up real quick. And he's like, all right, take him. And we see he fights Bruce Lee because he was talking bad about Muhammad Ali, Cassius Clay. So it's, and, you know, we see him beat the crap out of some hippies in this movie. And it's like, this dude is violent. Like,
right.
He could be very violent.
Oh, you know, I agree. I think that he, like, I mean, granted, if you can beat Bruce Lee one-on-one, because Bruce Lee, like, in real life, was a very...
He's Bruce Lee, yeah.
Yeah, he's Bruce Lee. He's very talented, he's very dangerous, you know, just in hand-to-hand. I don't doubt, like, I agree with you that Cliff has been trained and is violent. I don't know if I don't remember seeing anything where I'm, like, morally speaking, I questioned him, because the only times he really kind of lashed out, like, in violence is when a hippie, like, slashed his tires, and so he was like, clean my tires, and he said, or not clean my tires, change my tires, says no. And so he, you know, he kind of goes, again, in Tarantino fashion, kind of goes above and beyond, mm-hmm. and like, instead of just hitting him once, he hits him like four times.
Oh yeah, he like knocks his teeth out. Yeah, or
yeah, he knocks his teeth out,
threatens to, yeah,
change my tire, and then he changes his tire. Or like, he just destroys all these people in his house because they come in and we're like, we're gonna kill you, and they all have knives.
Yeah,
like I don't know, as far as like, yes, the above and beyond is there, but like, I don't remember him doing anything morally, like, as far as making bad decisions, if you, you know, like, I don't know. So
I guess that's
just
a good,
like,
point. I guess what I was just trying to say was that, like, he's not afraid to cross that line and go there, you know?
Yes, for sure.
And you're right about the whole, like, moral thing, because we see he is very much against statutory, because yes. Pussycat offers some fellatio in the car. He's like, how old are you really?
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, he's clearly keeping an eye out for it because everybody's keeping an eye on him. But all that to say, I kind of look at immediately what I thought of, the scene that I thought of, not again, to kind of make a callback to another Tarantino movie. I immediately thought of, spoiler alert, that scene in Pulp Fiction where, I forget their characters' names, but Samuel L. Jackson and
John Travolta.
John Travolta, thank you. How do I forget John Travolta's name?
It's okay.
Samuel Jackson and John Travolta are driving in the car. I remember this character's name. I think it's Marvin as his name, but he's sitting in the back seat and they're talking, and John Travolta kind of leans back and is talking to Marvin with his pistol hanging over the seat, and they hit a bump and he pulls the trigger and blows Marvin's head off.
Oh, yeah.
And they're like, he's like, oh shit, what happened? He's like, oh, I think I shot Marvin in the face. He's like, what? What? You know, in my car? Are you kidding me? There's blood everywhere. So I at least I pictured in my mind him sitting there with this harpoon, and maybe he's just like in, because clearly Cliff has like an anger problem.
Mm-hmm.
That's, I would say that he does have an anger problem, because he does, something bad happens and he goes, sweet, you know, the gloves are off. You've given me a window to beat the shit out of you. And he beats the shit out of people.
Yeah.
Instead of, he doesn't just disarm, he just pummels.
Yeah, he throws, which, you know, Bruce Lee into a car and dents the door.
Yeah, exactly. He kind of goes, he takes it a step too far. So, yeah, he does have, you know, he's definitely not just a perfect, like, sweetheart.
Right.
But I imagine him sitting in this chair with this harpoon, and maybe him like tilting it towards his wife, being like, it would, thinking in his mind it would be so easy, and him going, no, I better not. But then they hit a wave and his trigger pulls,
oh,
and it hits her and she falls in the water, and he's like, oh,
damn
crap.
It
yeah, damn it. And then he has to, like, maybe he covers it up, so
he's
maybe
like, how
he,
are you gonna explain this, Cliff? Damn it.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. He covers it up and makes it to where he looks innocent, but they're like, oh yeah, you for sure killed your wife. Which I'm going to say that my theory is he did kill his wife, but it was an accident. Kind of like if you're, you know, I guess this isn't the same as like texting and driving, but it's like, but at the same time it kind of is, where like you're driving and you don't see anybody in the road and you look down to, like, you're sending a text and you look up and you hit somebody. And you hit them. You did kill them, but you accidentally killed them. But technically, legally speaking, you are responsible for their life. So I'm going to say that legally, he is responsible and should probably pay the price for what I believe he did to her. But it was not purposeful. It wasn't out of, like, I want to kill my wife. It was, I accidentally murdered my wife.
I actually really like that take, that he perhaps accidentally killed her. Like it wasn't necessarily, like, a moment of weakness where he broke and killed her intentionally, but maybe it was just like the wackiest, weirdest, most unfortunate circumstances, and he accidentally killed her. I love that take, actually.
And he probably, knowing him, he probably, she died, and he was probably more concerned about his well-being than his wife, and he was probably like, oh my gosh, I killed my wife. Oh no, I'm gonna go to jail. I don't want to go to jail. So it was less of him being concerned about his wife's mortality and more of his well-being. So, you know, again, I don't know if that, you know, whether that's true or not, I don't know, but I'm just gonna, that's my take. What about you?
I love that take, Levi, by the way. I think that's,
thank you.
I think that's fabulous.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
I think he did. I mean, the first time I watched it, I was like, nah, I don't think he did. The second time I watched it, I was like, yeah, he definitely did. So, I mean, I guess it just kind of depends what kind of mood you're in when you're watching it that time. But right now, I think he did do it. I have nothing really to support that besides just that. I'm like, yeah, he probably killed her. I don't know. I kind of just think he did. I listened to Quentin Tarantino talk about this, and I love it because he doesn't have an answer either. He just says each answer gives you a different take on who Cliff is, because let's say he didn't kill his wife, then this poor soul has had to live with this scrutiny of him being a wife killer, and he's just had to deal with this guilt that he doesn't deserve, and, you know, he's actually like a very tortured person because of this. Or he did kill his wife and he's kind of twisted, and like, can he be trusted? And, you know, he kind of went into all this. He goes, I love that, because, you know, it just depends on the type of audience, how they want to cast, how do they want to cast Cliff as this person who accidentally did it or didn't do it or did it intentionally. And so, and that kind of changes your perspective of that character. And he's like, and that's different for everybody that watches this movie. And so I love that he doesn't even have an answer for it.
Yeah. And I, you know, I want to be careful about, like, I was about to say, well, this is what I kind of got from Cliff, but like it, they're actors playing these characters, right. So it's not like, like Cliff is a real person, but I look at people like Brad Pitt. So Brad Pitt plays Cliff. I see Brad, like Brad has just this charisma, mm-hmm. and Brad has this, yeah, kind of like this attractability about him that when he says stuff, it's just kind of like, oh, like he seems like a nice guy. Yeah. Even though, you know, Brad Pitt is just like everybody else in Hollywood, is like a rich white guy who, you know, may or may not be a nice person. Like, I don't know. Like, just that kind of, I don't know. But whenever I saw him, I'm like, oh, this character of Brad Pitt seems like a nice guy.
So let's kind of dive into some scenes that really popped out to us. I've kind of mentioned a bunch already. I love how this movie opens with Rick, Cliff, and Al Pacino's character, Mr. Schwartz. Not Schwartz, Schwartz.
Schwartz.
In this bar having lunch. I've kind of said everything I like about it. You know, just Al Pacino. We got him for like, it's like a 3-minute, 4-minute scene, but he was just great in this. I thought it was a lot of fun and really kind of shows that the type of movies that are being done in this era, you know, all these Westerns, and Rick is kind of self-deprecating a little bit because, like, he doesn't have confidence in himself as a movie actor because he was very successful on his TV show, Bounty Law. But when Al Pacino says, you know, I had me a Rick Dalton fucking film festival last night. And he goes, oh, I hope it wasn't too torturesome for you. Because, you know, he's like, oh, man, my movies suck. Like, I'm sorry you put yourself through that last night.
Right.
It's kind of like he doesn't have this confidence in him to be a movie actor. And Al Pacino's trying to tell him, hey, man, you need to, won't you, you know, you're being the heavy. You're getting your ass kicked by a different character every week. Go to Rome. Make some Italian Westerns, and you'll be successful. And it's just great. We really get who Rick is. He's like crying in the car. Cliff is being such a good buddy. He's like, man, it's not that bad. You could go to Italy and make some movies. That's not a bad life, man. And Rick's just like, those Italian Westerns suck. He goes, how many have you seen? So I just love this opening scene. It'll also get that great line of don't cry from the Mexicans. It's
I
don't know why that tickles me so much.
That is a good scene. Also getting to see Scarface. Love that. Get that gravelly voice. I love it.
Mm-hmm.
I love, one of my favorite scenes was the interaction between Rick and that little girl, Trudy, I think was her name.
Yeah,
Trudy.
She was awesome.
She was one of, if not the best actor in that whole movie.
Julia Butters is the actor's name.
Julia Butters. She was so good.
She was. And
it was just so natural. Like, you can tell, like, a lot of times you'll get, like, a child actor or whatever, and they'll start acting, and you can tell, like, you'll say stuff like, oh, they were pretty good for a child actor or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Or, that's one of the best child actors I've ever seen. It was just straight up acting. She was incredible. I thought she did so well. Just that you can tell. I'm sure we talked about this. I judge someone's ability to act based on how they do, not when they're delivering their line, but when they're not delivering their line. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just like you turn on to deliver your line and you turn off when you're not delivering your line. She was on the whole time.
Oh yeah.
And I loved, you know, especially this young girl playing off of one of the better actors of our generation in Leonardo DiCaprio.
Yeah, it's
was just so much fun to see.
It was, and she's giving Rick Dalton acting advice during all this. You know?
Yeah.
And she's giving all of these like actor mantras, whatever, you know, it's the actor's job to portray life as, you know, much as possible. We never actually accomplish it, but it's the pursuit that's important, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And she's talking about Walt Disney as a once in a lifetime or once in a generation genius, and Rick Dalton's just like, I'm reading Easy Breezy over here. It was such a joy.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, yeah, it's at the time, I guess they would have known by then the whole anti-Semitic ideologies of Walt Disney. I'm pretty sure he wasn't being secretive about that, but he was in, you know, there are a lot of geniuses out there that are evil too. So like evil geniuses or less than reputable geniuses. So yeah, I'd call Walt Disney a genius who was also an anti-Semite, just for what he did for cartoons and cinema and stuff like that.
Yeah. She also has that great line of, what is it that Rick calls her? He calls her like Buttercup or something like that, or Pumpkin.
Oh, it's like Pumpkin Squash or something like that.
He calls her like something cutesy like that. She's like, I don't like to be called that, but I could tell you're upset, so we'll talk about it later.
Yeah, it was so good. I also really liked this was probably my favorite scene in the movie. Mm-hmm. And it's not a big scene. I think it's technically just a little transition scene, but the scene where Cliff is in his trailer,
kind of
him going through his kind of regiment when he gets home, his talking to his dog and feeding the dog, and he like makes mac and cheese, grabs a beer out of his fridge, pops down, and like you could walk across his trailer in like two giant strides. Like it's this tiny, tiny little thing, and I don't know the idiosyncrasies of it all.
Yeah,
it's just so, it was so good, and there's something very artistic about it, about him making mac and cheese and then eating it out of the pot. It felt good. I really enjoyed that scene. It was a very soothing, very artistic scene. It was nice.
And I love all like the small details in this. Like I mentioned the name of the beer, Old Chattanooga, because I think Quentin Tarantino's from Chattanooga. I think.
Yes. Yeah, he is.
So, you know, you get that. And I love the name of the fake dog food brand, Wolf's Tooth. Good food for mean dogs. That's just fantastic. And now I watched, you know, all these. They were super purposeful in how they decorated everything in this movie.
Right.
Including his trailer. And I think he has a poster of some actress, and I forget who, but you know, they're like, oh, he definitely would have been one of these guys that loved this woman, or you know, whatever. So you know, so that's why we put that poster in there. He definitely would have been watching this TV show. And it's, we see this very close and tight relationship he has with his dog Brandy, and he has her very well trained, which, you know, pays off later on. So I agree with you. This was really cool. I also like that his home is at the back of a drive-in movie theater.
Yes. Yes. I love that. Yeah. I wonder, that was a really fun creative touch, kind of, and even the symbolicness of him kind of living behind the theater,
behind, he's like behind everything, 'cause he's behind Rick and,
Yeah.
Oh, Levi, kind of, you're so smart, man. You're so
thank you. Yeah, it was just, yeah, the symbolism of it, of the, you know, kind of the humble livings, but still, you know, by the screen but not in front of the screen.
Oh, that's so good. Oh man, I love that. Love stuff like that.
Thank you. Yeah, I don't know if he meant to do, I'm sure I,
oh no, he
Quentin Tarantino's, I'm sure he did.
Oh yeah, no, he spends 10 years making movies. Yeah, that was intentional, I'm sure.
Oh yeah.
I think my favorite thread of this movie is Rick's thread, especially when he's on Lancer and he messes up his lines with Timothy Oliphant's character. Mm. And, you know, he messes up, he keeps forgetting his lines, and he goes into the trailer and breaks himself down, has a freak out. This scene was actually suggested, or the freak out was improvised by Leonardo DiCaprio, but the whole idea to have Rick mess up, break himself down, and come back and kill it was Leonardo DiCaprio's idea. That wasn't in the script. I guess originally Rick was just supposed to do it fine, but Leonardo DiCaprio in an interview with Quentin Tarantino said that we need to, he goes, I really want to show, like, we'll show the audience where Rick is at as an actor. Like, we'll show him fail, show him go into the trailer, break himself down into, and then have to come back from that and nail it. And I loved all of that, because when it's crazy to the layers to this. So you're watching Leonardo DiCaprio, who's an actor, playing an actor who's doing poorly. So he's having to mess up on, but he's doing it on purpose, but he can't do it in a cheesy way. It has to look genuine, as like this actor is actually struggling. You know what I'm saying? So it's hard to, that's gotta be hard to do.
I mean, I'm sure that's why Tarantino, like the list of people that he wanted for, I don't know what his list looked like to play Rick, but you have to be deep. Like, you have to be able to go really deep into yourself to find, you know, to be able to act as an, you know, to be an actor acting as an actor and doing a bad job of it.
Oh, yeah.
Like, that's super layered.
It is so layered, and it's a lot of fun to me, and we just hear, like, the, like, when he asks for line or whatever, you hear the director off screen just yelling at him about what it is. Yeah. He's like, all right, I'll get it. And when he's in the trailer, he is just freaking out. It's tragic, but it's hilarious at the same time. And he's just calling himself an alcoholic. He's like, goddamn whiskey sours. Could have stopped at 3 or 4. And it's so good, because, like, in that freak out, he melds like 3 or 4 words in the one word somehow, and he's just you know, it's perfect when he's looking himself in the mirror threatening to kill himself if he doesn't do this right. When he's looking in the mirror reflection is looking directly back at the audience. So it's weird, because it's like I don't know if that's like a commentary on anything or whatever, but it's just fabulous. And of course, as he says, he's like, you're a piece of shit. You're an alcoholic. You're a miserable jerk, is what he calls himself. And he still takes a swig of his flask. He goes, what am I doing? And he throws it out the trailer. Oh, man. It was so great. I loved it. It's that clip by itself is on YouTube. It's such like a good 2.5 minute thing just to like make you laugh. Oh.
That's a good scene. The only other two that I had written down were, we already talked briefly about the Bruce Lee scene where he does the fight. I have the, let me pull up that IMDb page real quick, but the guy who played Bruce Lee, Mike Mo, he played like the mannerisms, everything was so good for Bruce Lee. I was so impressed. And yeah, just that whole interaction of just seeing, you know, you kind of go into it being like, oh, Bruce Lee's just going to beat the snot out of Cliff.
Right.
And then Cliff has just this ability to take a kick from Bruce Lee and then beat the snot out of him. It was just wild. I enjoyed that scene, and the last fight scene for you know, it, just the over the top violence was just that was a little much. But
I definitely want to talk about that last scene in a little bit. But I definitely want to talk about that.
Yeah, and I don't know if you noticed there the character who was the fourth person from the Manson family, her name Flower Child, I believe her name was, the one that sped off in the car. Yeah. Did you recognize her?
I recognize her from Stranger Things.
Maya Hawke. Do you know who she's related to?
Ethan Hawke. I'm going by last name, and I think Kat told me this.
Ethan Hawke? I mean, you're right. It is Ethan Hawke's daughter, but I was going for the connection between, because Uma Thurman is her mother, because she is the spitting image of Uma Thurman, who was in Kill Bill 1 and 2.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry, I kind of missed the point you were trying to make with that.
Yeah, no, but you're right. Like, it's like, yes, it is Ethan Hawke's child, but it is also Kill Bill 1 and 2's daughter.
Okay. That makes sense. Oh, that's cool. That's fun.
It's a fun little inclusion.
I was going to say, you mentioned Bruce Lee in this. This movie actually was banned in China because of the Bruce Lee scene.
No way.
Yeah, and they told Tarantino, you know, if you take out that scene, you know, we'll show this in theaters. And he said, no, I'm keeping it. And wow. The studio backed him on it.
I mean, I don't. Was it just because they felt like it was being dishonorable and mocking mocking this like legend?
Yeah, they kind of felt like it was. And honestly, I don't think it was. I mean, if you think about it, the fight was a tie. Like they were doing best of three, and they each one won. So it's not like he got his ass kicked or anything like that. So, I mean, at best, it was a tie. And also, I think I've heard some people talk about this, that it's up to debate whether or not that memory was real or not, because it's Cliff on the roof and he has his memory. So it's kind of like, how skewed is the perception of this memory when he fought Bruce Lee? Right. Like, did he actually win that fight, or did he kind of just handle himself or get his ass kicked, but the way he remembers it, he won, you know, or tied or whatever.
That's a really good point. Yeah, I don't think it was inappropriate, like, no. To a callback to Bruce Lee. If you're gonna play a character, play it as close to that character as you possibly can. Yeah. I mean, you watch that scene of him being Bruce Lee and then watch actual Bruce Lee. You can tell that they're different, but it's still pretty impressive.
Yeah, no, I didn't think that there was anything wrong with it. I mean, I thought it was fine. A scene that I really liked was, I think two more I want to mention before we get to the end scene, was, I liked all the stuff with Sharon Tate just having her day, especially when she's at the movie theater. I thought it was really fun because, again, this is kind of early in her career. She's not a big name or anything. Like, the ticket salesperson doesn't even recognize her name. She has to kind of sort of convince her a little bit. I also just love her in the theater watching her movies, and she's just giddy and smiling at everybody laughing at the jokes in the movie. It's like her going, oh my god, they like me, oh my god, the jokes are landing, like, oh, I do have a future in this, you know. It was, I don't know, it kind of warmed my heart a little bit to see that. I thought it was very sweet. I also liked how I kind of mentioned, she's trying to say, like, well, what if I'm in the movie, can I get a free movie ticket? Tarantino said he had this in the movie because he's done this before. In 93, a movie that he wrote, True Romance, came out, and he took his girlfriend out on a date to go see this movie, and he's like, well, I'll see if I could just get away with this. So he was telling the ticket salesperson, he's like, hey, I wrote this movie, is it okay if I just come in for free? And they're like, let me go get the manager. The manager came out, he's like, who are you? He's like, I'm Quentin Tarantino, I wrote this movie. He goes, never heard of you. And so he's like, well, no, here's my driver's license, like, the name matches. And he's like, buddy, I don't know, I've never heard of you before. And his girlfriend is now getting mad, she's like going to bat. She goes, no, he wrote this movie, like, he's directed many movies, like, he did Reservoir Dogs. And at this point, hilarious. Fans were coming up to him in line and asking for his autograph, and the manager goes, who are these people? And she goes, they're his fans, he is a famous movie director and writer. And so after fans came up and asked him for his autograph, they let him in for free. I thought that was funny that he kind of pulled that and put that in here. It was very fun.
That's hilarious. I mean, I can't imagine that ever happening to Tarantino. I mean, he is like a plain looking person,
but,
like, he's Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah, like, he's like, there are some like famous people that's like, they might look like so-and-so, but if you see Quentin Tarantino, it's like, he looks like Quentin Tarantino. There's nobody that looks kind of like Quentin Tarantino, you know?
I've never met anyone that looks kind of like Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah.
I'll give you that.
I think the last things I wanted to add was the whole Spawn Ranch thing, which I guess I kind of just hit all major threads in this, but Spawn Ranch was a lot of fun, or I guess not really fun. It was actually kind of creepy.
Yeah, it was very creepy.
And I thought it was very much a metaphor of, because they went to Spawn Ranch where this was, you know, this Hollywood studio mecca of making cowboy shows and movies, and now is being taken over by these irreverent hippies who don't even care about cowboys anymore. So it's really showing just the passage of time and how much Cliff and Rick's careers are being left in the past, and that they really do need to do something to transition. I found that interesting. And also, it was tense. Dakota Fanning was, you know, we only got a little bit of her in this, but
oh my gosh, dude, I did not even realize it was Dakota Fanning until afterwards. I was like, holy crap,
yeah, Squeaky,
that was terrifying. Who's the George guy? Who is that George guy? I don't, George something or other.
Yeah, I think he was somebody that used to work on the set there. I don't recall what his actual job title was, but he was somebody that used to work at Spahn Ranch as some sort of crew member.
Oh, I just looked him up. George Spahn or Spahn. He actually, like, in reality, he rented the ranch to Movie Industries to film Westerns. So he owned the ranch.
Owned the ranch. That makes
sense. He later truly did allow Charles Manson and his family of followers to live on his ranch.
Whoa.
That's a real thing. That's terrifying.
That's crazy.
Holy crap.
Whoa, okay, well, that makes it even that much more creepy.
but weird.
Yeah, I really liked all that. Another thing that we get from Cliff in this and how, like, violent he is, besides the actual fighting, when he's talking to Dakota Fanning, she won't let him in. He's just like, listen, I'm coming one way or another. He, like, knocks on the storm door. He goes, and this isn't going to keep me from coming in.
Right.
It's very much just like, he will go there. Like, he is not... Yeah. Yeah, he's not opposed to violence at all. So
yeah,
it was great. but any other things that really stuck out to you? You want to mention before we talk about the end scene of this movie?
No, I don't think so. I think we covered most of the scenes. I was just like, yeah, that's a good one.
Okay, cool. I just want to say my dog is snoring, so I apologize if people people hear her snoring. So we get to the scene. So we get to this end scene where it's like 6 months later, and Rick is coming back from Italy, and he now in 6 months he did like 5 movies, has a wife now, and
yeah,
which is, you know, crazy 6 months. And him and Cliff are having one last hurrah, and then, you know, here comes trouble. The Manson family comes. I want to say I love how this kicks off with them, with Rick, drunk as shit, coming out, holding a blender full of, like, margarita mix, and he is just screaming at these hippies. He's like, take this mechanical asshole down the street. I pay taxes for this private street. And he's just yelling at them, and it's so... I was kind of nervous. I was like, oh man, are they going to kill Rick right here in the street?
But, yeah, I was waiting for them to just, like, blow a hole through his chest.
Oh, it was so tense. And then Cliff gets high off an acid dip cigarette. It's just so, like, this whole, like, fight scene with Cliff and the three hippies in this, and him and Brandy are kicking their asses. It was, it was an awesome payoff, I thought.
Yeah, it was intense. I'll give you that. It was intense. I thought it was the... I forget the dog's name.
Brandy.
Okay. Brandy, love that. Like, the interaction between Cliff and Brandy was really fun, of, like, the snap or the whistle or whatever, and immediately this dog jumps into the mix and is, like, taking these people out. I loved it. Or, like, you know, the Brandy taking care of the...
It's fantastic.
The wife kind of sleeping in the bed or whatever. Yeah. Oh, I love it. And it was just so, I like it too, just kind of the addition of that the Manson family members coming to, like, kill, they are kids, like, just straight up. These people are children, and they kind of have to talk themselves into it. Essentially, you know, at one point they say a line that kind of implies that, we need to do this, because if we come back and we don't do this, people are going to be mad, and we don't know what's going to happen. Like, this, we need to make this happen, because, you know, there's, you know, Manson's ranch is this paradise or whatever, but if you don't do what he says, like, it will not be, you're not in a good place. So it's just, like, the kind of the realism, and even the flower child being like, I forgot something, and her just taking off.
Yeah.
And not playing those games. It's, oh my gosh, it was very, 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 I was so sure that we were going to watch Cliff and Rick just get brutally murdered. Honest to goodness, I thought that we were going to see these people get brutally murdered in place of Sharon Tate. I thought this was supposed to be an alternate universe where instead of Sharon and her husband and ex-boyfriend getting murdered, it was going to be this actor and his stunt double.
See, I was thinking, oh man, are they going to show us Sharon Tate get murdered in this movie? Like, I was on edge the whole movie because I thought that's where it was leading towards.
Yeah, that crossed my mind too. I asked Rachel as they were coming up, I was like, Rachel, they are not going to show this 8-month pregnant woman get murdered. There's no way.
That
would not fly. There's no way. I'm glad they didn't.
Yeah.
But it was, yeah, that last scene, it was intense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was really good. And, you know, Cliff handles them pretty well. And we also get some really funny lines in this too. Because he recognizes Tex. He goes, I saw you earlier today. You were on a horsey. And he's like, what was your name again? He's like, I'm the devil, motherfucker, or whatever. He goes, nah, it was stupider than that.
Yeah. And he says something like, they walk in, he goes, are you real? And he goes, real as a donut.
Yeah.
And I was like, what does that mean?
I didn't know, but I was like, did Tarantino watch Knives Out before he wrote this movie?
Right?
Yeah. Oh, man. And then I loved the part where one of the hippie girls runs out into the pool and Rick has no idea what's going on. He's like, what the hell?
Yeah.
And she has a gun too that she's like firing. So that's how he knows that she's dangerous. He goes into his pool shed. And I love that he kept the flamethrower from that World War II movie he did. It's so, oh my gosh. It's like, why did he keep that? I don't know, but fuck, that's hilarious.
Yeah, that was him just being like, yeah, I kept it in my shed. And they're like, seriously? He's like, yeah, I mean, yeah. And like, not a prop flamethrower.
It's a real
one. Like, imagining Rick getting off the set and be like, hey, can I take the flamethrower home? He's like, sure. And it's a work, not like a tiny little, like, it just shoots flame. Like, this thing is like industrial side, like strap it to your back, pumped full of just, blah, like, flamethrower. And they just let this guy, I mean, you know, I guess it's the 60s or whatever, but.
I love your explanation. It was the 60s. Everybody had a flamethrower.
Yeah, this stupid stuff happening in the 60s.
I also love that quote you mentioned earlier about him being saying, like, can we do something about the heat? Rick, it's a flamethrower. Apparently, Leonardo DiCaprio ad-libbed that.
Really?
Yeah, apparently. I don't know if it's true, but I read in the trivia that he ad-libbed that part, which I think is great because that's one of the funniest parts.
I'm sure it was. That does sound like an ad-lib. That's very funny.
Yeah. I love the bromance between Rick and Cliff in this. And yeah. Cliff is being taken away by the ambulance. And Rick is just like, Cliff, man, I owe you, buddy. He's like, man, just see me tomorrow morning. Bring me some bagels or something like that.
Yeah, like, bring me a bagel and coffee or something like that.
Yeah, bagel or donuts, something. And he's like, all right, buddy. It's so good. I love their bromance. And
I do, too. It's very sweet.
And then, you know, it finishes with Rick is talking to his neighbors, and he gets to tell Sharon Tate, you know, about what happened. And he walks through the gates, walks up and talks to them, and it ends with, you know, once upon a time in Hollywood, you know, what could have been. And it's just such a perfect ending, I think.
Yeah, it's very, very satisfying just to know that that Sharon Tate wasn't murdered, and like, she probably would have lived to, you know, an old age and built a family and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. It's sad if you think about it that she wasn't really given that chance.
Yeah. I've kind of mentioned throughout this movie throughout this episode what I thought my message and takeaway things of this, you know, it's Tarantino's love letter. It's about, this movie is about aging and how there comes a point where you have to, we got to stop living in the past and make a transition to further expand your horizons.
Yeah.
Because you know, we see that, obviously, we kind of see that difference between Sharon Tate early in her career, Rick Doll and Cliff Booth late in their career, and they're having trouble getting gigs. And when Cliff, I'm sorry, I keep getting mixed up. Sorry, folks.
I know. They're closer than brothers, but not quite as close as wives.
Thank you for that. In two short names with eyes in the middle.
Right, exactly.
And Rick, when he's in the makeup trailer for Lancer, you know, they're like, hey, you gotta, this is how we picture you. This is how we want to design or dress you and do the makeup for your character. We want you to be like a hippie. He's like, I don't want to be a hippie. I want to be a cowboy. He goes, no, you're going to be a cowboy, but this is like a new cowboy. It's kind of like even his idea of what a cowboy looks like isn't right. The norm anymore.
Yeah.
And so, and it wasn't until he was able to really embrace this evil character that he was playing, what they call him, evil sexy Hamlet. That is when he really just nailed it. And that's when he kind of had his wake up call. Like, wow, if I can transition and I probably should. And yes. So that's when
Evil Sexy Hamlet was my nickname in high school, by the way.
Was it really? I can't tell
if
you're fucking with me
or not.
Not
even close.
I couldn't tell if you're fucking with me or not. But I was like, man, I believe it, I guess. I mean.
No.
But yeah, so that was kind of my takeaway message of the movie that I got from this.
I had such a hard time thinking of a message for this movie. I just could not. Like, I was, you know, looking behind the curtain, like, there's more than meets the eye. Like, the people in the background are just as important. Like, don't join a cult. Like, I don't know. That should be the moral of every movie. Don't join a cult. But yeah, I guess it was more of just like, you know, there's more. You know, for everything you see has tons of people or tons of time or tons of energy put behind it. What you get is not all that there is. There's more behind it. I don't know. I had such a hard time with that. But, you know, because like Cliff as a stunt double, like he's been through the ringer and he works super duper hard and has to take all these jumps and risks and health, you know, whatever. And he's still treated kind of like scum, and all the stunt doubles are kind of treated as lesser, you know, than the actors themselves. So yeah, I don't know. Stuntmen are people too.
Stuntmen are people too.
I don't know. But yeah, I kind of hard time with the moral of the story. It just kind of, it felt like us getting to see kind of what inspired Tarantino to become Tarantino, just like this genre of film. You know, the past of filmmaking that kind of built him, you know, kind of created him and built his empire.
Gotcha. Okay. Did us talking about it help at all with kind of coming to like any sort of takeaway from this? I'm just curious.
Yeah, a little bit. Like I can appreciate the movie a little bit better. I was kind of waiting for there to be some sort of like linear plot to the movie, you know, some sort of, this person is going here, and then that person is going there. Like even the Hateful Eight, kind of they what is like 85% of the movie or whatever, they stay in like one room.
Gotcha.
And you know, there's still like this plot, like there's still this linear movement to being like, we started here, we're trying to get there. And this movie, I was looking for that, and there was never really a clear like, this is where we are, and there's where the movie is going to end, and we're going through the journey together. It kind of just felt like we were kind of wandering around, like, you know, instead of a treasure map being all straight lines, it was like loop-de-loops and, you know, going over and back and turning around and whatever. So, you know, if I view it like when you said Tarantino's love letter to, you know, L.A., the 60s, the movie craze or whatever, you know, the cowboy genre, I can appreciate the movie a little bit more, for sure.
Okay. I guess we'll kind of end this with some rapid-fire questions I got for you.
Please.
Would you recommend it? Will you rewatch this, and should there be a sequel?
Okay. Would I recommend it? Definitely depends on the person. But yeah, I don't think this movie, I wouldn't deter anybody from watching it by any means. Will I watch again? Yes, I will watch this movie again. I will probably watch it again sooner than later, just so I can watch it with the lens of Tarantino, kind of like this being Tarantino's baby.
You gotta have, you gotta be drinking a whiskey sour while you do it, man.
Honestly, honestly, I think that's what's going to be a little bit different. I have to have a whiskey sour while I watch this movie. And what was the third question?
Sequel. Should there be a sequel?
Oh, sequel talk. No, no, not for this, not for this plot line. Now, unless the sequel is the, what do we say, the 14 Fists of Fury or whatever it's called. 14
Fists of McCluskey.
McCluskey, yeah. If that is technically a sequel, then yes, take my money. I there needs to be that sequel, which I guess technically if Rick is starring as the lead in that movie, I guess it would be, or a prequel, I guess it'd be a prequel.
Yeah, it would be.
So yes, if it's the 14 Hands of McCluskey or whatever, then yes, I want that prequel so badly. But if it's a continuation of like with Sharon Tate and Rick and Cliff and us moving forward, nah, I think it ended pretty well, just to see that you know, everyone kind of, Sharon Tate, you know, is alive and her family is alive, and kind of panned out to be like, see, you know, Manson didn't win. And the end, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. So I'm gonna say no, you know, no sequel unless it's a prequel. What about you?
So would I recommend it? Absolutely. High recommend. Will I rewatch it? Absolutely. I think this was one of the most rewatchable movies from 2019. If not the most rewatchable. Sequel talk, I have to agree with you. No, I don't think there needs to be a sequel. There's really no room for one, in my opinion. And I think it's fine how it is. However, so the show that Rick Dalton was on, Bounty Law, Quentin Tarantino has said that he plans on writing and directing a Bounty Law Netflix series.
Oh, no way.
Yeah, he's been adamant about wanting to do that. And dang, I will tune in for that if they do it.
I will absolutely turn in for that. How long do you think he'd do a series for?
10 parts, maybe? I don't know. I mean...
Oh, I love it. Oh, I'm in.
Oh, boy. Well, I really like this movie a lot. This is... I've been looking so forward to talking about this. I'm so happy that we finally got to. Such a great movie. I also just wanted to... Since we kind of started doing this, we really appreciate our listeners and people that have been... giving us shout outs and giving us any sort of feedback. It's been making our days just so much brighter. Thank you so much for people who have been leaving us reviews or emailing us or tweeting at us. It's been awesome. I just want to shout out to a person or listener named Katie. She left us a very nice review on iTunes saying that we are her favorite movie podcast. Thank you so much. It really, really makes our day. And Katie's also an artist. You can follow her on Instagram at
Katie, that's so sweet of you to give us a sweet review. Yeah, as you read her Instagram handle out, I'm going to look it up.
So you can follow Katie. She's an artist. You can follow her on Instagram at The Haunted Outfit on Instagram. So The Haunted Outfit. She likes to read like 90s young adult like horror books, and she will create outfits for these characters on her Instagram, and it's a very fun concept. I think that's very cool. So shout out to Katie, and thank you so much for brightening our day with a nice review. Dang. It was really fun to wake up to seeing that on our iTunes feed.
I'm looking at Katie's art right now. This is so impressive. Katie, you don't need me to tell you this, but you are incredibly talented. Good gracious.
Love it. So if you want to do something nice for us, you know, leave us a review, email us, tweet us at Film on the Rocks, or follow us on Instagram at Film on the Rocks Podcast. We are so thrilled. This is the first episode that Levi and I have recorded since we did the Talks on the Rocks episode, and we have gotten such a positive response to that. We want to keep the fun going, so please send us in your questions, emails, and you know what? If you have a funny story you want to tell us, send it in to FOTRpodcast@gmail.com. and we'll read your funny story. If you want, if it's something super embarrassing, you want to remain anonymous, that's cool. Or if you're like, hey, my name's Bob and I pissed myself one time and this is what I did, so you know, that's cool too. So
yeah, I'm sure that'll spark some pretty incredible conversation.
Yeah, so just be sure to get that into us so that way we have that for our next Talks on the Rocks episode.
Love it. Thank you guys so much for all of the amazing reviews and amazing commentary on our podcast. Seriously, y'all support means everything.
Yes, absolutely does. And so what we got planned for next week is the Patriots, actually,
whoop,
right?
Whoop.
Yeah. So thank you so much for listening. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, Film the Rocks, Film the Rocks Podcast, or email us at FOTRpodcast@gmail.com, and we'll see you next week with the Patriots.
Yes. Bye, guys. Thanks for listening.